Written and directed by hip-hop artist and activist Boots Riley, Sorry to Bother You is a satirical, allegorical tale of a young black man living in Oakland whose life is going nowhere. Cassius Cash Green, played by Lakeith Stanfield, is staying in the garage of his uncle and surviving day-to-day, hanging out with his artist-activist girlfriend, Detroit, played by Tessa Thompson. Cash puts together a phony resume and secures a job at Regal View, a telemarketing company. When he's advised by a colleague, played by Danny Glover, to use his, quote, white voice, Cash starts to move up the corporate ladder, eventually gaining access to the golden elevator taken only by the power callers. While Cash is seduced by the world of power callers, his Asian American co-worker Squeeze, played by Steven Yeun, and his best friend Salvador, played by Jermaine Fowler, are organizing a work stoppage and union campaign at the call center. The moral conflict in this allegorical tale unfolds as Cash's attempts to rationalize his success confronts the brutal realities of a dehumanizing capitalist order. He must decide whose side he is on as his former co-workers and friends fight the bosses in a wildly absurdist denouement of class struggle. Well, friend, part of the film that's talked most about is this idea of performing whiteness, where the film really is clearly a political satire, and his co-worker, played by Danny Glover, gives him a tip, hey, young blood, use your white voice. To have a white voice is to sound breezy, carefree, like you don't really need the money. It's what white people wish they sounded like, Danny Glover says. So what about this theme of performing whiteness? It's been taken up quite a bit by the film's devoted fans and critics.
Yeah, and the devotion is well-deserved. I mean, we want to say, you know, if you haven't seen this movie, run, don't walk. But yeah, the whiteness is not essentialized. It's a performance of ease and leisure and not needing, of being worry-free.
It's denaturalized, so there's no, in the sense that whiteness also is a construct.
Yeah, whiteness is a performance just as blackness is a performance. Although the characters' voices are in fact dubbed by white actors, and a little bit out of sync to make it all the more surreal and weird. And it's a real thing, right? Code switching or the idea that sounding white will present advantages is something that's been documented in social science, that there have been studies. In fact, if you sound white, you will succeed more.
And is he saying there that there are class inflections? There's a class hierarchy of racial codes throughout this film.
Yeah, of course.
Well.
Yeah, of course, there are white people working in the call center. So their white voice doesn't naturally sound worry-free or carefree, but it's very clearly coded in terms of whiteness as property, whiteness as wealth and comfort, upper class whiteness.
And a fantasy of whiteness. And in a sense, just as gay men often can perform femininity in drag and a kind of perversely idealized picture of femininity, the black character knows how to perform whiteness in a way that white co-workers don't understand the codes, because he knows how to switch codes.
At one point later in the film, he's asked to perform blackness, which he has a little more trouble with, but manages to do to the satisfaction of most of the white people present. He's at a party asked to rap, because, of course, all black people know how to rap.
But I think it also registers something about the ambivalence that's part of the white gaze, fascination with blackness, both avoiding it and fearing it, but also this fantasy of blackness as transgressive, as aggressive, and the consumption of rap, I think, conveys some of that ambivalence that's part of the white gaze. What about gender in this film? It's been praised for the intersectionality, as we say, of how racial representations come together and around class as a unifying social position, people coming together to fight the bosses. And there hasn't been as much written about the performance of gender in this, even though there's a performance artist at the center of the film. Detroit.
Yeah, well, she's not exactly at the center of the film. She's a little bit off center. She's not the main character. She's the main character's girlfriend, as your introduction aptly correctly described her. And that's her role in the film. And this film does not pass the Bechdel test, or the Bechdel-Wallace test, as it's sometimes called. Alison Bechdel, the cartoonist, and her friend Liz Wallace. This is from a 1980s era Dykes to Watch Out For strip in which a character says she has a rule about what movies she'll go to see. It has to have two women who talk to each other about something other than a man. And more recently, critics who've taken up this idea of the Bechdel test have noted that it really they should be named female characters who talk to each other about something other than a man. And the film does not pass that test. That is not a reason not to see it. But
on the other hand, she also works with the white gaze. She wears these earrings that have these big texts, murder on one, kill on the other. And it's as though she knows what blackness evokes and arouses in the nervous, as they say these days, fragile white sensibilities and this fear of black people. And so she's kind of speaking back to that. She also performs.
She does this performance where she's wearing very little except some strategically located gloves and a pair of sunglasses. And then later in the performance, she's wearing a helmet. She talks about the minerals that go into cell phones, which are extracted from Africa. And she has people at the gallery pelt her with bullet casings, cell phones, and balloons full of sheep's blood.
Which could be read as a masochistic performance, but I read it as her working with this idea of even with this intensive exploitation that Africa stands and can withstand, and it has not been destroyed by all of this exploitation, as the embodiment of a certain African resilience.
Which is a great reading, and I think works, because the character is somebody who definitely pushes back against her boyfriend's ideas. She likes him better when he's one of the workers before he becomes a power caller, and she ends up breaking up with him. At least one reviewer has used this as an argument that she does not fall into the trope of the manic pixie dream girl. The manic pixie dream girl being this kind of trope of the wild and crazy and free, creative young woman whose sole function in the film is to free up and help along the main character who's a little more uptight and suffering and so on. And she's not quite that, but I don't think that the film really subverts that trope. She's not there to have her own story, although she does have more of a trajectory than your average manic pixie dream girl.
So what about this worry-free world of workers that's behind the scenes? One could say that this is a film not about producers, but about the world of commodity circulation of sales. It's about selling useless commodities, though there's a hierarchy of sales in this world represented. But the workers that are we don't really see much of are buy into a kind of a company town on a large Brave New World scale.
Yeah, this company Worry Free that invites people to sign a contract for life in which they will have housing and food and jobs for their lifetimes. And basically, it's moving into a prison and being slave labor for the rest of their lives. And this starts to look attractive to some of the characters in the film, Cash's uncle in particular, when he's worried about his house being foreclosed on and he can't figure out what to do. And, well, at least he'll get three hots and a cot. So the idea of this sort of brave new world of labor being basically slavery and incarcerated prison labor, but with a happy face because you go there because you're worry-free, is one of the many amazing and surprising and delightful tropes in the film. But we don't see the work that the worry-free workers do, except at one point in a kind of cartoon version where we see a little claymation account of some of the workers. But this is really about the kind of capitalism where we see less of manufacturing and really the organizing is happening at this call center at a different kind of, not point of production, but point of sales. So, I mean, there is value being produced insofar as the workers are generating profit.
And commodity circulation,
but they're not the ones actually making the commodities.
But it does differ from some films where you have this, you know, this dystopian new bad future and everybody's a kind of zombie character. I mean, the worry-free world is a worry for the capitalists, though. That also is a theme in the film. There's always a threat of resistance. We don't see it among the producers. But this idea that under capitalism there's always a threat of resistance is, I think, an idea that the director is committed to politically. creating and participating in resistance in films like this that show the possibility of resistance.
When Riley was on Democracy Now!, he talked about the way that the left has sort of moved to emphasizing spectacle and demonstrations and away from, as he says, actually organizing at the point of contradiction in capitalism, which is the exploitation of labor, which is also where the working class has its power. And so really he's emphasizing, the film is emphasizing the importance of withholding labor in the process of gaining power as workers. That is what the union struggle in this call center develops into. And so, and of course, at that point, Cash is, just as they start this drive, they have a brief work stoppage, and then he's promoted to power caller. And so he tries to sort of say, well, I'm on your side, I'm cheering for you from the sidelines, but then he ends up having to cross the picket line in order to get to his job. And we've got scenes of these incredibly armored up goons, G4 Wackenhut types of soldiers, really, protecting the scabs and the workers who are going into the call center building through the picket line.
And someone throws a can at him. And then this, I think, another interesting way in which the film departs from some of the liberal ways of thinking about resistance is that he becomes quite preoccupied with exposing the brutality of the world he's now part of. But just exposing it becomes the video of him having a can thrown at him, a Pepsi can, circulates and becomes a meme and part of kind of pop culture. So it, in a very clever way, works with this idea that it's not enough to just expose the inhumanity of capitalism.
But it can be part of it, or it can be, those kinds of images can be used in subversive and progressive ways for organizing. So, and he finds out some stuff about this company that sends him over the edge. It's no longer worth being a power caller. It's too horrifying, and he wants to expose it, which he does after, I mean, he goes through a lot. He suffers further violence in order to bring this to public attention. And then, as it turns out, instead of everybody saying, oh my God, this is terrible, we must shut down this company immediately, their stock goes up. And the CEO appears on television with Democrats and Republicans praising his prowess and the new creative frontiers in employment and labor that they're moving toward, right? So that just the thing that he thinks is going to be...
to break through...
doesn't.
Yeah. Right. And capitalism can always incorporate the critique.
Can always incorporate. Yeah. And the organizer, Squeeze, points out that when people find out something horrible, if they don't have a way to address it, they're just going to find a way to ignore it because there's no other way to move forward if you don't know what to do about it. Right. How do you stop something like this? But the can on the head, which becomes a meme and he's laughed at for it, actually also becomes part of their resistance strategy when they're fighting back against the union-busting thugs. Everybody dresses up in these costumes with a wig and a Coke can on their head so that they can't tell who's who. And so it becomes a kind of camouflage to use that as a way of confusing the dominant powers as part of a larger strategy for organizing and rebellion.
So that images and representations can be taken up in multiple ways, and the film can be perhaps used in social movements in different ways. There's perhaps a risk of always of satire and irony that's playful to be remain at that level of part of a satirical critique of capitalism that falls short of confronting it. But I think the aim of the filmmaker is to contribute to social movements and to think about class and resistance, if even in this science fiction, Afrofuturistic fantasy way, that there are always possibilities for resistance that we haven't figured out yet what forms they'll take.
Yeah, and one of the things that Riley said in the Q&A he did when he was in Portland is that somebody sort of asked him about this tension between, he's saying representation isn't enough, but he's making a movie. Isn't that another representation? How does that fit in? And one of the things he said was that it's important to have have different kinds of stories, and that different kinds of stories can be enabling for people to take different kinds of action. The story alone is not going to be enough, but it's a contribution toward that. And I think that this movie does that. I mean, it gives us in this very surreal way that I think is quite in tune with the surrealism of actually existing life under capitalism today. It gives us ways to think about the importance of organizing and the possibility of organizing and of people coming together across different categories. I mean, when they have this rebellion, which culminates in a successful unionizing drive, doesn't completely overthrow capitalism, but they organize their workplace. And that's something, right? That having that story is important. And there aren't enough movies that offer us stories of labor organizing. They're few and far between. And it's great to have one that's this much fun.
Yeah. This is Jan Hawken and Fran Michelle talking today about Sorry to Bother You.
So we should say, in case anybody tunes into this accidentally, this is Fran Michelle and Jan Hawken still talking about Sorry to Bother You, but we're now talking about the ending, so if you haven't seen the movie yet, go out and see the movie and then come back and listen, okay?
Or it's your choice.
Well, okay, I'm just saying. If you don't want to be spoiled. All right, so at the end of the movie, what it turns out, the horrifying thing is that the worry-free company is turning people into half-human, half-horse figures.
Breeding a new species, right?
Equisapiens.
Uh-huh. Part horse, part human. And the idea is that they're very worried about this worry-free world of pacified workers, and that there will be rebellion, but that they want to be able to. There's also this idea that under capitalism, you have to have motivated workers, and the horses represent horsepower, but also a kind of intense capacity for activity.
Workhorses.
Workhorses. Yes. But also, I think horses are eroticized in many ways, and Black men and men in general often seen as studs, and mm-hmm. so they're associated with a kind of sexual masculine energy or power. So they're not just beasts of burden in the European imaginary, we might say, but yeah. represent something also, a sexualized masculinity and power.
Yeah.
Horsepower.
Horsepower. Power to the horses.
Well, and that was actually something I was wondering, that there is often a way in which dehumanization is framed in terms of what you can do to animals that you can't do to people. So to dehumanize a person is to treat a person like an animal, as though it's permissible to be brutal to animals but not to people. And for some, that's the measure of, it's a moral boundary, treating people not as though they're animals. And of course, Donald Trump uses animal references in referring people coming from Mexico, and it's not only meant to deny their humanity, but suggests there's a boundary that is acceptable.
And that is reinscribed by that very
notion of treating, that to dehumanize is to treat a person like an animal. And so I thought there was perhaps a bowing toward a kind of, and solidarity with animals, an animal rights perspective in bringing bringing humanity to horses, mm-hmm. as well as casting this new breed of workers as animal-like, horse-like.
Which I think makes a certain amount of sense, although, of course, it also, I think, harks back, you know, not only, as you say, in terms of these ideas about Black male physicality and sexuality to the era of slavery and after, but also in the sense that, of course, during the period of slavery and for some people after that, right, that African-Americans and Africans were not thought of as fully human, right, that there were ideas that there were different species of people, right, that racial difference was a kind of species difference. So I think it may also be playing with that idea. At the same time, it also is not only, I mean, one critic suggests that it harks back to Pinocchio, where some of the children in Pinocchio are lured to this island and then they're turned into donkeys and taken into slavery. That it's so the idea of humans and horses and donkeys is connected with the history of slavery in that way. But I also wonder about the extent to which it has a different kind of valence if we think about it in terms of, say, Gulliver's Travels, where the Houyhnhnms, I mean, the horses in that book are the smarter, better, kinder species. And the Equisapiens, although the term Equisapiens is obviously built on equine and Homo sapiens, also suggests a kind of equality with sapiens, right? That the horses are as human, in a sense, the equisapiens are as sapient as the humans.
So there's a kind of cross-species ethics or solidarity that these are not just passive beasts of burden. They also have the potential for revolt and resistance, and the aspect of our humanity that drives production, our being these motivated animals as people, that is always part of producing a surplus under capitalism, extracting labor. The problem of the capitalist, the worry is to extract labor from labor power. The potential of work always has to be realized through motivated workers, getting people to work to produce a surplus for capital. And here you have that aspect of horse-human power, but it's in the form of resistance. And so the film ends with that in a way that leaves a lot of people lost the storyline when it moved in this sci-fi direction. That's kind of divided audience responses considerably.
Yeah, not everybody is ready to go there where the film goes at the end. But I think it works. And I mean, one of the characters says explicitly, "One struggle, one fight." The horse people who are designed were told by this crazy capitalist, who's not crazy, he's perfectly reasonable, as he explains. He wants him to know he's not crazy. He's doing this to make money. It makes perfect sense.
That rings true these days.
It really does. But they're supposed to be, the pitch is that they will be more docile than ordinary workers, as well as physically stronger. But of course, they are not more docile. They're in fact just as rebellious. What we see of them is they're fighting back against the forces of capital power.
And Cash, who's appointed as the new leader of these horse humans by the capitalists, is seen as a potential Martin Luther King. And that's an interesting also version of Martin Luther King that's a product also of the white imaginary.
Yeah, the boss, Steve Lift, says that he wants him to take the role of the sort of a fake Martin Luther King, to lead them, but in a way that will be co-optable by the capitalist
class.
To
manage the rebellion,
to pacify the rebellion. So, I mean, this is how King is seen, but of course, that's not the only Martin Luther King. That's the, right, had he been alive, when he was alive, he was seen as quite dangerous. When he was killed, he was in Memphis to express solidarity with striking unionists. So it's
garbage workers who also deal with the refuse of the society and are treated as a subhuman in a certain way, doing the dirty work and taking up that struggle.
Yeah, but that's not the version of MLK that the capitalists are trying to replicate.
Right. That history gets so sanitized. So working with that draws, I think, it depends on the audience readings mm-hmm. of it. And so many films and how you interpret this Detroit wearing earrings, one side says kill, kill, the other earring says murder, murder, murder. How you read that depends so much on your interpretation of those signifiers, whether she's embodying the threat that whites often experience when they look at a black person and kind of pushing back and playing with it, or is she saying something else with that? Those earrings also apparently are for sale online, which is...
You can get merch. You can buy her t-shirts too.
But that was I'd like to buy that t-shirt.
Yeah.
The one scene she wears this wonderful t-shirt that has emblazoned on the front, "The future is female ejaculation." So there's that. Yeah.
Playing with the very bland version of "the future is female."
Yeah.
And it's like, no, the future is female ejaculation. So... For The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michelle and Jan Hocken talking about the end in this clip of Sorry to Bother You. See it again.
Talk among yourselves.
Yeah, there's stuff you notice on the second viewing that I didn't see the first time I saw it. So
that's right.
It's worth a second view.